The following presentation of the Midland City Council will begin in a moment. The Midland City Council is the city's legislative body that sets policies, approves budgets, determines tax rates, and adopts ordinances and resolutions to govern the city. It is made up of 5 elected officials that represent the wards in which they reside, and councilmen are elected to 2-year terms. The mayor is elected from among the council members by vote of the city council. City council meetings are held at 7 p.m. 2 Mondays per month in the council chambers at City Hall. This presentation is provided by the MCTV Network, a service of the City of Midland. Replays of this meeting can be found on MGTV Channel 188 on Charter Spectrum, through Channel 99 on AT&T UVerse, or on demand at www.cityofmidlandmi.gov. Select meetings are available on MCTV Network's Government Affairs podcast channel.
All right, good evening and welcome to our February 5th, 2024 meeting of City Council. Please stand and join us for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, Lacey, will you please call roll?
Honorable Mayor Donker.
Here.
Councilman Arnosky.
Here.
Councilman Wasbinski.
Here.
Councilman Brown Wilhelm.
Here.
Councilman Soler.
Here.
All right, thank you very much. Does anyone on council have a conflict of interest with anything that's on this evening's agenda?
No, Madam Mayor.
Okay, seeing none, then we'll move on. And that takes us to the consent agenda. All resolutions marked with an asterisk are considered to be routine and will be enacted by one motion. There will be no separate consideration of these items unless a council member or citizen so requests during the discussion stage of the motion to adopt the consent agenda is indicated. There's even a single request, the item will be removed from the consent agenda without further motion and considered in its listed sequence in regular fashion. All right, can we have a motion to accept the consent agenda?
So moved.
Second.
First and second. All right, anyone want an item removed from the consent agenda? All right, seeing none, anyone from the public want an item removed from the consent agenda? All right, seeing none, then all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, that passes 5-0. All right, that takes us down to item number 2. One of our most favorite things is to hear about our golf course. We always look forward to this report. And Carol Stone is here to introduce that to us.
So good evening, Mayor and City Council. We had an exceptional year at Curry last year, thanks in large part to our professional management team from Indigo Sports, who are here this evening, Nick Bednar, Paul Milholland, and Jerome. And they are here to give you a synopsis of the year. So I will turn it over to Nick.
Thank you.
Okay, good evening. Thank you, Carol. My name is Nick Bednar. I'm the vice president for Troon and Indigo Sports. This is actually 10 years ago today. I think we're standing here, well, across at the other building in our first year at the time with Billy Casper Golf. But it's been a great run the last 10 years. We're going to go over some of the accomplishments of Curry and what's going on. So look forward to that. Carol mentioned our general manager, Paul Milholland, and Superintendent Jerome Blonick are here. These are the guys who make it happen day to day in their team. So certainly deserve all the credit for what I'm about to walk through. So I'm going to spend a few minutes. I want to keep the focus on Curry, but I think it's important to find out what's been happening in the game of golf. It really has been a dynamic time over the last 5 years, especially for the game of golf. So looking forward to sharing that story and how Curry has fit in and really exceeded what the rest of the industry is doing. So without further ado, up on the screen is a pretty good state of the golf industry for the last 13 years. The Great Recession had a big impact on golf and a lot of industries, but in particular ours. Golf course closures became I want to say the norm, but we had more closures than openings for a long period of time, and we still do today. We have more closures than openings, but that was really a supply correction that was needed. What happened at about 2016, there was an inflection point in demand for the game of golf. So pre-COVID, we started to see some signs of the growth in the game in terms of participation, and that's the top line there. You can see in 2022, we continue on an upward curve on the dark green line in total participation. The lower items there, the bar chart, is the growth of off-course golf. So if anybody's ever heard of Topgolf, simulators, some of the ways that people experience the game outside of on the golf course really has been exploded over the past 10 years with the advent of simulators and Topgolf and things like that. And it actually has proven to be a place where people learn the game before they come to the golf course and been a big reason why people are interested in playing golf. So on-course participation is now above where we were during 2010. We have 26.6 million people in America who played the game on the golf course last year. So we've recouped what we lost during the Great Recession and then some in terms of the actual people who played a round of golf on the course last year. Mentioned off course, this one's interesting. Topgolf has, I think everybody kind of knows the story of how that has grown to over 30 locations and people are going there. It's more of a golf entertainment type space. But simulators have really taken off just over the past 4 years. So over 6.2 million people played golf on a simulator last year, either at a simulator business or have a simulator in their home. So this is interesting, particularly for northern locations like Curry, something we keep an eye on. Troon manages dozens of locations that have simulators as well, but it really makes golf a year-round sport.
Can I ask you, what does it mean dozens of places have simulators? Is it like a top golf place, or is it like golf courses have simulators?
All right, so we do, Troon actually has a stake in a company called Golf Zone Social, and we have bar, restaurant, golf spaces that have 20 simulators in their bays where you can play simulated golf. Most of the golf courses that we operate have one, two, three simulators that are there for the public to use during the off season. So that's the most common use of simulators. And we have done some early due diligence at Curry as to whether this would be a potential fit. Certainly climate-wise, we have the challenge this time of year. How people get on the golf course, although we're trying to get the actual golf course open with the recent warm stretch we've had. But this is a trend, and you can see it's growing in popularity. It's growing in practice among golf course operators and just business owners in general. So it's a trend. It's something we need to keep an eye on. It's part of what has made golf more popular. Younger generations are just as happy getting together and playing golf this way in some ways as they are on the golf course. So 73% growth in the simulator space just in the past 4 years. Pretty remarkable. And another positive trend in the industry is it is getting more female. We are about 26% female participation right now. That's up from sub 20% 10 years ago. So what we're seeing is at the youth level, we're seeing a much closer participation rate among girls as boys. It's about 40 to 60. So as time grows on and more girls continue to play the game as they grow older, that gap will close. And again, the off-course space, Topgolf has stated that 50% of their play is female. It is literally a split, 50-50 between men and women. So again, that's feeding this as well. And on the screen shows, we've gained, over the past 3 years, we've gained over 1.5 million golfers. Actually, 1.3 million total, but 820,000 of those have been women. So two-thirds of the growth has been female over the past 3 years. Great sign. Again, something we need to stay on top of to continue to cater to more women playing the game. So before we move on to Curry, again, golf's in an interesting spot right now. There's a lot of optimism about the game. Participation rates are at the highest level they've been at in 15 plus years. 2023 saw more rounds played in the United States than have ever been played in a single year. Topped 2021, which was the previous high water mark. Off course venues continue to explode. There's a latent demand for golf, meaning there's more people interested in playing on the golf course today than there ever have been. And that has grown year over year over year. So more people are interested in picking up the game, which is a great sign. And off-course supply is still in contraction. We're starting to see more golf courses opening. These are tending to be more resort-type properties and private golf clubs. We're not seeing the explosion that we had back in the 80s and 90s where real estate developers were putting golf courses in. So I think the industry has learned, the industry has learned the balance that's needed for supply and demand. Sure, more golf courses will open, but we don't see that going back to 1998, where 380 golf courses opened in 1 year. It doesn't seem to be trending that way. Obviously, inflation has had an impact. We're paying more for our labor. We're paying more for our supplies as well. But revenue is outpacing that. So with that said, I'm excited to move on to what has happened here locally at Curry, because 2023 was a record year for the facilities. Actually, one more industry slide before I get to that, but I promise it's relevant. So mentioned 2023 was the highest rounds volume we've ever seen in America. Rounds were up 4.2% across the country, up 4.5% at public facilities. Golf is weather-based, so each region has different results here. Michigan was up 0.5%, so really was relatively flat to 2022. But not at Curry. Curry was up 11% over prior year in rounds. This is the first time we hosted over 50,000 rounds at Curry. Hosted 53,491 total rounds at the facility. This is up, you can see 2020. Obviously, some things happened that year, flood, COVID, closures. But other than that, you've seen Curry on an upward trend, really, since 2017, and we're up 30% on participation over the past 5 years. So that's driving the results on the revenue side. Again, 10 years, we've been tracking this under our leadership of the facilities. Going back to 2014, total revenues at Curry were just over $800,000. This past year, they were over $1.85 million in total revenues. I think it's just incredible.
It's awesome.
Yeah, it's incredible. And I'm sure we promised that 10 years ago. But you can really see the last 3 years are where things have really, really taken off. And that's a combination of the volume, and it's a combination of, obviously, pricing coming back to where we needed to be post-flood. This is the bottom line. We were brought here to stop a loss that had occurred for many years at Curry. Obviously, the first few years, we saw some reduction in the subsidy to the golf course, and we're on a positive trend up to 2020, got past that year, and the last 3 years, we've posted profits the last 3 years, with this past year being the record year, $195,000 of total earnings. Pretty cool. All right, growing the game. So we're proud to be the host site for a driving range practice facility for the Dow Great Lakes Bay Invitational, soon to be called the Dow Championship. That was hosted July 19th through 22nd. Again, hosting many of the elite women golfers in the world. It's a really unique tournament where two LPGA players play together. It's great for golf in the area. We host 250 plus kids at our first tee event there at Curry, the Monday of it. And it's one of the best, busiest weeks of the year at Curry, but a great showcase for the facility. And we just get so many compliments from the players as far as the facility that Midland has there at Curry. It's coming back June 27th through the 30th with a new name. So we will again be the host site for the practice facility. I want to spend a little time here because this is, Paul and his team deserve a lot of credit. This is not something that's new, but has grown through time. A lot of effort into junior golf at Curry. You have a great facility to learn the game at Curry, not just with the driving range, but the par three facility. The East Course kind of be a stepping stone to the West Course, which is a championship layout that can take some of the best players and challenge them as well. So. Junior golf camps and programs have been going on for the last 10 years. We hosted 88 participants, which has been pretty stable. These are junior camp that happens during 1 week during the summer, but also have weekly junior golf clinics that are hosted by the staff at Curry. The Drive, Chip, and Putt is a national competition that ends with local qualifiers going to regional qualifiers and eventually having the opportunity to play at Augusta National, which is where they host the Masters every April. So a lucky set of kids will have the chance to play at Augusta the week before the tour players go there. And we had 100 people to participate in this at Curry to try to qualify on, and that was double what we had the previous year. So that's gaining some steam. PGA Junior League, this is, as the name suggests, this is a PGA of America initiative that's been going on for about a decade, has grown by leaps and bounds. This is akin to Little League Baseball. Kids play on teams. They represent age group teams, have numbers on their jerseys, and it's really just a cool way to learn the game. You play in fun formats in addition to stroke play formats. We were able to host 7 teams at Curry, which is 58 kids. That's one of the biggest programs in the state for PGA Junior League. So a lot of credit again to Paul and our PGA professional, Doug Temple, who's the coach of these teams. We actually had two teams that qualified out of the local region, one of which finished 2nd in the state, and another one went on and finished 2nd in the regionals in Illinois. So they're taking this well beyond just playing at Curry, and it's pretty cool to see. Great Lakes Bay Junior Championship. This is in partnership with the First Tee of Eastern Michigan. Hosted our first event in 2022 and had 40 competitors. Stroke play competition. Last year, that was up to 62. So continuing to grow that competitive event. Mentioned the First Tee program. We had 133 participants for First Tee program. That was up from 97. So again, this has been about 5 years since we've been partnering with First Tee, and it continues to grow and grow each year. And then last but not least, Youth on Course. This is, again, a national program that fundraises and helps subsidize junior golf. So essentially, Curry offers its round of golf at its normal price. The junior has to come in and pay $5. So they never pay any more than $5 to play. And then Youth on Course reimburses Curry for the difference between our normal rate and the $5. We hosted over 1,500 rounds of Youth on Course, so coming and play and out of pocket, no more than $5 to play. So that's the biggest, again, the biggest in the state. So pretty cool. A lot of kids coming to learn the game at Curry, and obviously that's great for the future of the facility and great for the community.
Nick, just curious, you've been talking about all these youth programs. What's the age group that qualifies in these youth? And there, is it all the same for all of them?
It's so under 17 is what we would consider a junior. So the PGA Junior League, for instance, we have teams ranging from 8 and 9 year olds up to 17 and under. So again, it's kind of similar to the Little League. You graduate year by year and play against kids your age.
So are most of them from Midland, or are we attracting from other communities?
That's a great question. Paul would probably be.
PGA Junior League and
Paul.
First Paul. So because of the First Tee program is more of the Great Lakes Bay region, so we attract from the Great Lakes Bay. And the First Tee or the PGA Junior League, we attract from the Great Lakes area as well. But the bulk of it is Midland, okay. But we do attract from Saginaw Bay City.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks, Paul. So Doug Temple, I mentioned our PGA professional, also brought a program called PGA Hope, which is an adult-based program, and it's for veterans of the military from all branches. So this is aimed at bringing, obviously, people who have served in the military together, for various reasons, wanting to enjoy the game together, whether it be coming back from overseas duty and whatnot. But PGA Hope is going helping our patriots everywhere. We have the biggest program in Michigan at Curry. Again, 40 veterans participated in this throughout the year, and it's really just kind of a great scene to have all the people out there who served in our military.
Okay, can we have Paul again, because he probably will need to answer this. So Paul, I know that you've done fundraisers there before, but how do you attract these veterans to come to Curry and golf? How do you go about doing that?
Well, the PGA Hope is a national program, mm-hmm. and Doug Temple, who was one of our pros at Curry, he's involved and actually won an award for the state of Michigan for the Veterans Association. And so he's the one that goes out and tracks all these people. But we do it on our website. We do it through the Michigan website as well, PGA Hope. And that's how they're basically, that's how we get them to come to Curry Golf Course. A lot of it's just word of mouth, too. And so we started maybe with 10 or 12. Now we're up to 40. And to be totally honest with you, Doug, what he does on Mondays, he brings these veterans in, and he works about an hour with their golf swing. And we work with their golf swing, and after that, we get them on Curry Golf on the East course, and they go out and play nine holes in the East, and they have a ball. They love it. So it's been, it's growing every year, so it's up to 40. We anticipate about 50 or 60 this year. So it's big. Yeah.
Thank you.
The last item on here is outing participants. And again, this is not necessarily a Grow the Game initiative, but the reality is a lot of people may only play a few times a year in outings. But this is great, a great story as well. In 2021, we had 2,800 outing participants, and that grew all the way to 4,300 outing participants. So that's, again, word of mouth. I think people want to host their event at Curry. They want to have their special day, fundraise as well. And it's a huge driver of revenue for the facility as well. So mentioned that Curry is hosting 53,000 rounds. On average, people pay $25 to play at Curry. So you know, again, golf may have a reputation of being expensive. It's really not. If you know the program that's right for you, playing nine holes or par three, our most avid golfers buy memberships. We had 63 annual pass holders. That was up from 53 in 2022. Range memberships were up again from 31 to 37. Birdie Pass, this is our most popular program. Over 1,250 of these cards sold. So for $20, you can get a discount that ranges anywhere from $2 or $3 up to $9 off your round of golf. So we're doing our best to keep this accessible and affordable while improving the golf course along the way. And it's been successful. Thanks to you all, we were able to get some facility improvements in 2023. Very, very important to the overall upkeep of the golf course. The equipment package, the last equipment package we had at Curry was before Billy Casper Golf. So, you know, a lot of these units we were running were 10, 15, 20 years old. So we were able to get new greens mowers, fairway mowers, rough units, utilities, greens rollers, and top dressers. That will allow us to continue to keep the golf course in the standard that we want to keep it and continue to provide a better experience for golfers. The irrigation satellites, this was helped along the way by the flood, but a necessity to replace many of the satellites that were on the golf course that allowed Jerome the ability to control the irrigation centrally. Literally since the flood, Jerome has been handling this manually. That's a lot of time and a lot of inefficiency to keep the golf course watered. Now, at the push of a few buttons, we can program and irrigate again. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Walk-in coolers and a freezer for the restaurant. We had a storage issue in the kitchen, so now we can keep, obviously, everything we need to service the additional volume. And then clubhouse landscaping improvements for curb appeal. So what we're looking forward to this next year is really just building on what we've done since we've been here. I mean, we have taken a tremendous amount of pride in trying to be the best public golf course value in mid-Michigan. And that's what we're going to continue to try to live up to. So continuing to enhance our reputation, you got to do that by staying current, continuing to provide the best conditions, the best service. And just stay in touch with what's going on in the market and try to stay, you know, one step ahead. Revenue optimization, we have some nominal price increases for 2024. I don't think any one of them goes beyond 5% of what we were charging in the prior years. And then just continue to grow the game. This is, as I mentioned before, this has been not something that's happened in the last few years. This is something that started small and has continued to grow bigger. And I really think Curry leads this market in growing the game, and we need to continue to do that. It's part of the mission, should be part of the mission of the city of Midland to continue to engage the community and the next generation of golfers. So with that, I welcome any other questions that you may have.
So from a national level, you mentioned the number of women golfing is going up. Are we seeing that here in Midland too?
We are. It is a little more difficult to track. You know, the point of sale software we have doesn't necessarily identify one name as female versus male. Mm-hmm. So there is, I guess, more anecdotal evidence of it. But it is, you know, and we're seeing more, again, more of the newcomers to the game skewing female than male.
You know, one of the things we talk about is our aging population, and we know that there's going to be a major shift in that in about 10 years. And so it's nice to hear about the things you're doing for youth to get them out there on the court, on the golf course. But it's also, is there, you know, more ways you think we can incentivize or encourage seniors to be out there playing golf?
Yeah, and we continue to offer a senior rate. We have senior leagues as well. So, you know, again, I think just offering the accessibility piece of it, you know, Curry has some distinct options as well. You know, if the championship course may be a little too hard for you, you have the East Golf Course, which is a little bit easier, a little shorter for seniors as well. But again, I think all the programs that we offer, the Birdie Pass program, which keeps it even more affordable for seniors who buy that card. And, you know, again, seniors tend to skew more toward weekday rounds of golf than weekends. So just understanding the player and trying to deliver what they want.
I guess picking up on that, is the course staying pretty full throughout the week all the times?
A few things help that. First off, more people working from home has helped. That's been a big reason why post-COVID golf has grown, just a little more job flexibility. We're busier on the weekends, without question. But the outing business, a lot of that may happen during the week and fill up the tee sheets more than it had, you know, 5-10 years ago as well. We're still per capita. We're doing more rounds of golf Friday, Saturday, Sunday. But, you know, our rates are different during the week as well to try to push more volume.
You think we'd ever have a simulator at Curry?
I have had that vision. So is Paul. Again, you know, this is a recent trend. So something we've looked at, and not just recently. We have some options in mind, have discussed them with administration, just to kind of get a sense of whether it might work. It comes down to return on investment. Does this make sense financially? Does this service the mission of helping to grow the game? I would say it's more and more viable as the years go on and we see more people playing the game this way. There are simulators in town. We keep track on how they're doing and whether there's, you know, additional need for simulator in this market. And we're tracking how these other simulators are performing in Troon so that when we come back to you, if we come back to you the next year, 2-3 years to do something like this, we have good data for you to show, yes, this is a winner and this is why.
Okay.
So I hope so.
Yeah.
But we'll see. Yeah, I mean, it's obviously going to take some investment and we want to make sure that pays off.
All right, any other questions for our guest?
I want to ask how much of investment is required for a simulator and ROI.
Yeah, and again, I round numbers. So simulators vary in quality. You can get a simulator for $5,000, $10,000. They go all the way up to $75,000 for a top-end simulator. It depends on where it's going to be housed. You know, at Curry, you have limited space. I think you'd want to take advantage of the fact that you have a restaurant and bar right there that could service it. Back where the deck is potentially would be a spot for it. It's call it a $500,000 investment. And we need to figure out how much we would make back. Ideally, you'd make that back within 5-6 years. It's viable. Am I ready to present it right now? No.
No.
But again, it's a trend. Again, this is part of our duty to the city of Midland is to keep an eye on this and avail you of opportunities that can help continue to grow revenues and support golf in the community.
Well, we've certainly have come a long way since the first time you guys were here. And I remember some of those early conversations. And so it's really exciting to, you know, have you here and talk about simulators today and what, you know, what we can be even more in the, you know, as in years to come. So it's exciting for us. It's great for the course. It's great for this, I think, our citizens also to have options available to them. So thanks a lot for taking the time to be here today from the sunny south.
Thank you for the partnership. We really enjoy it and enjoy being part of this community. Thank you.
Great. Okay, That takes us down to public comment, and this is an opportunity for people to address council on issues relevant to council business, but not on this evening agenda. Is there any public comment this evening? Okay. Again, come up, state your name and address, please.
John Elson, 6106 Sturgeon Creek Parkway, Midland, Michigan. Been a while since I've been here. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I just wanted to say, being a concerned citizen, and this is my community, I really care for it. I've just noticed a few things that have concerned me over the last couple of months. One of them is not hiring a city engineer. I think we need a city engineer. I think putting somebody that's not an engineer in that position is not good for that person or the community. I mean, I remember back in Aberdeen, Scotland, where I was working for BP, and they hired a process and procedure person to be the drilling manager for the whole region. Didn't know a thing about drilling, couldn't help anything, couldn't talk to her, even though you had meetings every day, she didn't understand. So they ended up having to hire two people to sit next to her all the time to explain to her what we were doing. And actually, after that little episode, maybe a year later, upper management finally realized that was just kind of like not a good place for that person to be in, or for the other people that had to work in that position to have somebody that really didn't have the knowledge of an engineer and understand the drilling business. So I think it's not very fair to either that person, because it's not, they don't know anything about what an engineer is, and the other one is. The other one is, I just don't think that is also good for the efficiency of the group. All right, and that's number one. Number two is these new apartments. I know you guys voted on it last week, and I mean, I understand that people want housing, but I think if people really wanted housing, there'd be a lot of developers eager to do about anything they possibly could do to build, because they know they'd be making money. But in this case, it seems like we're giving away money to have more housing. And, you know, I've been here for, I mean, well, the last 20 years I've been back in Midland. And I've been through a boom, and a bust and a boom, basically, in that same time. And housing is going to be variable over time. So what I just concerns me the most, kind of going back to when they first came up with this River Caddis thing, I think there was like 202 apartments, but I think there was only like 157 parking spots or something less than the number of apartments that are there. I would assume it'd be at least one parking spot for every single apartment there, considering, you know, most people are going to have a car. Some of these apartments will have two cars. And I just don't quite understand that idea of parking. So where are all these people going to park at? They're going to go across the street and park at the community center? They can't park on the road at night. I just don't understand. Are they going to build a parking lot somewhere? They want somebody to build a parking lot? I just don't understand the logic behind not having enough parking spots for the apartments, for the amount of apartments that are going to be there. To me, that just seems like not very good planning. So I can see the people around there, why they're going to be concerned, because, you know, let's say you got a lot of younger people in there, they're going to have a lot of people visiting them. Where are they going to park? Community center? Walk over there? Can they do that? I mean, I'm not sure that's even possible. They want to do that. They can't park on the street past, I don't know what it is, midnight or 2 o'clock in the morning or something like that anyway. So that's number two. And the other thing that's coming up, and it hasn't come up yet, but it's going to come up, I'm sure, is going to be the Circle redevelopment. I saw that. I saw that in the Midland Daily News this weekend. Read it. Me and my wife both read it. We don't understand why cutting off Jefferson is even any kind of an idea. It just seems to me to be insane to cut off Jefferson. So I can't go for proposal one, where you make a circle. I can't go for proposal two, where you just basically cut off Jefferson. It doesn't make any sense to me at all. And I know that the plan hasn't been finalized yet, but I would suggest, since we just went through the Ashman and Rod thing, I suggest now you get the public opinion now, so that you can maybe get something where everybody will be happy with what you're going to do, not just presenting it to the masses saying this is what we're going to do. Even if 80% of you don't like it, this is the way it's going to go. It doesn't make sense to me. I think you should actually do it now and make sure that people, you've got the people of Midland on your side, not like Ashman and Rod. So that's for me for the night. I'm glad to be back, and we'll talk to you later.
Okay, thank you. Any other public comment? Okay. That takes us now to, I turn my page here, sorry. Item number three, the capital improvement plan, Mr. King.
Thank you, Mayor Donker, members of council. Try to keep it brief tonight. There's no simulator for golfing in the CIP, so if there's any questions about that, let us know. Suggest that Paul put that forward next year if they want to see it in the next six. So as you all know, the capital improvement plan is a multi-year tool that we use not only at the city of Midland, but cities around the country to identify what our future infrastructure and other capital needs are going to be. This lets us use the money that we have available to us for capital purposes efficiently and effectively. It can also help us to implement our master plan. In Michigan, we're required to create a capital improvement plan under the Michigan Planning Enabling Act. This helps us to keep the public informed about our plans for infrastructure as well, and then align those investments with our priorities for growth and development or redevelopment around the city. Within the capital plan, last year we increased our capital thresholds, and so this plan reflects spending on items $15,000 or more for capital purchases, $50,000 or more for infrastructure assets. That captures basically everything capital related that we're going to do, even at those higher thresholds. A variety of funding sources help to supply the funding for these projects, everything from special assessments to the county road millages, state funding, state revolving fund is playing a big role in our current capital plan. Enterprise funds, like our water and water reclamation funds, federal funding, tax increment financing through our tax capture districts, and grants and donations also play a huge role in making projects happen in the city of Midland. So looking at our six-year plan overview, if the entirety of the plan were to be implemented as proposed, infrastructure investment in 2024-25, the first year of the plan, would be at $69 million. And we have $264 million, almost $265 million programmed over the six-year plan period. Today, we've had no public comments. The Planning Commission did hold a public hearing on this plan at their last meeting, and no comments were received. And we're about three quarters of the way through the approval process for the plan. Planning Commission had this plan introduced to them in January. They held a public hearing at the second meeting in January. We're introducing the capital plan to you tonight, and we'll bring it back for your consideration for adoption at your next regular meeting. So now we'll go through each area of the plan and see if there's any comments or questions. So area one is our airport. So pretty much business as usual at the airport in terms of identifying some of the capital needs in the short term. One thing I'll note here that's sort of unique is our tree mitigation program. We've got some obstruction removals that are programmed here. This is the first year of a multi-year project. And so that's at $100,000 in the current proposed budget for 24-25. Overall, in the six-year plan, there's $2.3 million in improvements proposed at the airport. Moving on to the Center City Authority in 24-25, design and engineering for the Saginaw Road Phase 2 streetscape project is shown at $500,000. This is funded through some of the residual funds that were left from the completion of the Phase 1 portion of the project, so primarily outside funds, I believe, that were used, committed to that project that ended up not needing to be used. The remainder of this six-year plan and $9 million, so $8.5 million, relates to the construction of that project. Midland Civic Arena. A lot of improvements proposed for the Civic Arena that primarily relate to the infrastructure within the building, either heating or cooling. We have a controller at $70,000 that's shown for the current fiscal year. We We've got just over $1.8 million in projects proposed at the Civic Arena over the 6 years of the plan. Dial-A-Ride has no projects proposed in the current upcoming year, the first year of the plan. In the six-year plan, there's $1.2 million shown. That is primarily for bus replacements and dispatch software. So we'll have our two bus replacements are programmed for the 25-26 fiscal year, one in 26-27, another in 27-28, as well as two van replacements and dispatch software during that year. The Downtown Development Authority, we talked a little bit back in December at the special projects meeting about the downtown restroom project at $500,000 in the first year of the plan. We also have Larkin parking ramp signage that's in the current plan for our current fiscal year that's proposed to roll over into 24-25. And then the first of several years of programming of funds for potential redevelopment of the riverfront. Those are projects that would be contingent upon the receipt of either grant funds or bonding by the Downtown Development Authority in order to start to bring the downtown riverfront redevelopment plan to fruition. Just over $1 million proposed for the 24-25 fiscal year, $8.5 million shown in the plan over the six-year plan period. Stepping into the engineering part of the plan, to provide kind of a big picture overview, we've got six major street projects proposed in the upcoming fiscal year, one of which is a cost share with MDOT. We have 10 local street projects shown. We have some interagency projects. And so again, MDOT is proposing to resurface M20 Isabella Street from Curry Parkway out past the western city limits of the city of Midland. And so there'll be some participation on that project in the upcoming fiscal year. We also have reconstruction of Sweet Avenue from East Ashman to Wheeler. If you've been in that area recently, you'll note there's been some survey work taking place to begin the engineering for that project this year that is funded in part with some participation through MATS, some federal funds.
So is our portion still between 10 and 15%?
Yes. Yep. And that M20 project, again, that's a mill and overlay, so a lower price tag than we'll see for some of the other upcoming projects on Business Route 10 with reconstruction, where there's a higher dollar figure attached to the extent of the work. Look at the general budget for engineering. So these are just some of the items that don't fall into our local or major street funds. We've got engineering for our sidewalk improvement program at $25,000. The sidewalk improvement program itself at $150,000. A new line item this year for tree replacements, $200,000. And this is to help mitigate impacts to existing street trees as a result of our local and major street projects. And then our wayfinding signage maintenance program at $100,000 for just shy of $500,000 in the upcoming fiscal year. The general budget for engineering just shy of $3 million over the six-year period. Moving to local streets, this is about a $47 million plan over the next 6 years, just shy of $10 million in the upcoming year. Almost $3 million of that $10 million is related to Concept 5 and the local street portions of those projects. We also have $1 million identified for the mill and overlay program and an additional $200 for surface treatments. You can see the list of projects there otherwise listed on the screen and in the plan.
I have another question.
Sure.
So there are some local streets repaved last year, and it wasn't a very good job done. And are they coming back to redo it?
That's my understanding, yes, is they'll be back to fix that. And we don't have any chip and seal projects program for this fiscal year for the projects that were discussed as being problematic.
Just curiosity, if they're going back to redo it, is it on this list or is that separate from this list?
It is not on this list.
Okay.
And do we have to pay for it because it was such a bad job?
My understanding is that they're coming back to do that work as part of fulfillment of the contract.
Okay, good.
Moving to major streets, again, just shy of $10 million in the upcoming fiscal year proposed for major street projects, a little over $50 million over the six-year period. Again, you'll see pretty similar miscellaneous services related to major streets. We've got a little bit of money related to Concept 5, significantly less than we do in the local street program. $500,000 for the mill and overlay program. Some funds allocated, as we do every year, for non-motorized improvements, preliminary engineering, soil borings, and $400,000 for our surface treatment program. As I already mentioned, two of these projects, the Swede Avenue and the M20 project. We also have the St. Charles Street project, which will run from Whitman to Benson, which will tie into the Poseyville Riverfront Park. That project is being held back for construction until that project is complete. So we'll hope to get that accomplished during this upcoming fiscal year, but probably in the spring of 25. We also have a major project on Jefferson Avenue running from Patrick to the Circle that would probably be important to note. Tonight, you actually approved bids for the James Savage and Rockwell project, and so that will hopefully be kicking off yet this summer. And then Dublin Avenue from Oak Ridge to Saginaw, another major street project program for the upcoming year. Traffic services is the next to last part of the engineering budget. Relatively minimal here, some traffic counter replacements, purchase of some additional GPS equipment for some of their data collection and field work, and then some contribution towards potential storage expansions out at the Municipal Service Center. So just $100,000 in the upcoming fiscal year, $300,000 in the six-year plan. And then finally, the water portion of the engineering budget. These are water projects related to major or local street work. $2.3 million in the upcoming fiscal year, just about $32 million over the six-year plan period. Moving into the ERF, the Equipment Revolving Fund, or our fleet services program at the city, we've got just shy of $4 million. And equipment replacements in the upcoming fiscal year, and just about exactly $20 million over the six-year plan period. And so you can see the list of vehicles that are proposed under that plan to be replaced in the upcoming fiscal year. So we've got the usual police units and a variety of equipment that's related to parks or public works. Moving into facilities management, a few minor projects here at the Municipal Service Center, replacement of the electronic key card access system at $80,000 and a walk behind floor scrubber at $18,000, just under $100,000 for the upcoming fiscal year for facilities management. Moving to fire, we've got some, did you have a question, Mayor Docker?
Well, I'm just trying to understand all these, you know, vehicles that we're buying. Are any of these electric? Are these all gas? Are we like meeting whatever standards we're supposed to be meeting with all this? I don't know really what I'm asking there, but I'm thinking, no. Oh my gosh, you know, we just looked at some, you know, Dial-A-Ride electric vehicles. And I think there's some goals out there on a, you know, countrywide basis as far as, you know, when we're supposed to be having, you know.
Sure.
I mean, I'm driving a gas-powered car. Let me just say that. And it makes me a little bit nervous, the other stuff. So
are we
meeting all those, whatever goals we're supposed to be meeting? And I don't know what those are.
Well, we don't have any specific dictates on us as a municipality in terms of a transition from internal combustion to electric vehicles. That's, at this point in the state of Michigan, a totally voluntary transition on a, you know, piece of equipment by piece of equipment basis. As we discussed back in December with the acquisition of the Dial-A-Ride electric vans, that is giving us an opportunity to examine the benefits and the drawbacks of that technology on a fleet perspective. Obviously, we'll look beyond vehicles at our equipment as well, where there's electrification opportunities, but that we're still new to those vans, and so there'll be some time needed to learn from that experience. So at this point, the vehicles that you're seeing proposed in the six-year plan, as well as in the upcoming fiscal year plan, there's no specified intent of transitioning any of those vehicles from their current formats into electric.
Okay, thank you.
But is it fair to say that for some departments, electric vehicles will work very well, but other departments, I'm just not sure that would be the right answer?
It's going to depend. So, for instance, some police departments have moved towards hybrid vehicles around the state, where they've got some of the best of both worlds. As I look within the building department at the city, I think there's some real opportunity for possible electrification. Those vehicles are primarily used to travel from home to home or business to business to do an inspection. They are parked each night at City Hall, so there's plenty of opportunity to provide an adequate charge for what would be needed in a typical day of travel around the city. And so that would probably be a relatively simple transition, all things being equal. Some of our heavier equipment, obviously, the technologies have to catch up to even provide us with the choice to go electric if we chose to.
So the facilities for the Dial-Ride electrification station, is that going to be for next year, or have we already done
that? That has already taken place.
Okay, I was just sure if it was completed. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, we have two of the electric, the transit vans that Mr. Kane mentioned that are in operation. We're evaluating right now. They're not performing quite as well in this cold weather that we've had recently. So that's one of the things that we're being careful about and monitoring as we go forward. Doesn't mean that they're not working. It's just not quite what we expected initially when they started. So as Mr. Kane again mentioned, we will continue to look at it for other options as well. Part of it's the infrastructure, of course, that has to come in. Part of it's grant availability and different dollar sources.
All right, moving to the fire department. I'll highlight here that we do have an addition to the plan, not in the current six-year plan. This is proposed in year one of the proposed plan, which is $60,000 in concrete repair to Station 3 due to some cracks that were discovered late last year in the truck bay of that station. And so that $60,000 will help to address those issues and get the station in good repair. We also have a full description in the plan of the station alerting software. This is basically a more contemporary way of waking staff at the fire department when there's an emergency call during their shift in a way that's better for the health and safety of the firefighters and still gets them to rise and respond. And so that is shown for each of the three fire stations at $50,000, just over $200,000 in the upcoming fiscal year, just shy of $1.5 million over 6 years. I should say too, this is not including anything that might come out of the fire study, being that the timing wise, we don't yet have the results of that study to integrate into the plan. So I would anticipate this time next year, we may have some minor or major adjustments to the fire portion of the six-year plan, depending on what that study indicates. So moving on to Curry Golf Course, again, no golf simulator, sorry. But we do have some car
paths. It's nothing in 2930.
Maybe 3031, we'll see. Yeah. We do have some car path restoration and staging at $300,000 in the upcoming year. That work, we've got some initial design taking place right now to help support that work, just over $1.2 million over the course of the six-year plan.
Where does the profit that we just heard about factor into this cost? They made $180,000 in profit this past year at Curry Golf Course. Is that extra cash, extra profit used towards these expenses?
So
I'm the capital plan guy, not the budget guy.
So part of it is we still have debt on the golf course, so there are payments back towards the debt. There's a funding and a share ratio that goes on between the city and Indigo Golf as to how those profits are shared. So they do get a portion of those, certainly, but some of it comes back to help with our debts. Okay. And obviously, looking forward, that would continue until that debt is fully paid off.
Okay. All right. Moving from the golf course to the landfill, I've got a number of projects here, three quarters.
So information services didn't have anything.
Yep, but we didn't want to leave them unacknowledged. So partly because we want to make sure that if and when they do have capital projects, that we have them in the plan, we don't lose track of them as a plan area.
So it's not that they're not doing anything. It's just it relates to large expenses.
I will assure you that they do plenty.
I know they do a lot. They do a lot. Okay.
No, just nothing that hits capital. There are other departments not represented here as well, including two of mine. So
yes.
Still very busy, just not doing capital work. Moving to the landfill, we talked again back in December about the leachate treatment system. I'm sorry, pre-treatment system. And so we've got some initial engineering funds programmed in the upcoming fiscal year in the event that we have the opportunity to begin that engineering work. Otherwise, a variety of smaller projects are proposed, including some improvements to the gatehouse at the landfill. About $750,000 in the upcoming fiscal year for projects at the landfill and equipment. Six-year plan, largely driven by that leachate pretreatment system, is just over $11 million. Okay, bouncing over to the library. In the 24-25 year, we have a backup generator identified at $600,000. Six-year plan is just shy of $3 million. This backup generator, you may recall, is viewed as critical by the library because of the flooding impacts that result when pumps that keep floodwaters out of the library aren't able to operate during power outages. That drove some of the damage that occurred in the library in 2020. And so this generator has been identified as a priority project by the library. Moving to MCTV, just one project in the upcoming fiscal year, a sports relay system for their local sports programming at $35,000. The six-year plan, just over $400,000.
So Jacob, just before you leave that one, there was a note under the MCTV about replacement of their aging wireless camera systems being moved to 24-25.
Yep, we need to update their narrative. So I've been working with the MCTV director. Thanks, Mayor Donker, for noticing some errors in those narratives. And so we will have at your next regular meeting some updates to the MCTV section of the plan.
Thanks.
Moving to parks, we've got some projects, a project at City Forest in the upcoming fiscal year, front staircase and handrails for the chalet. We have, moving on to other park facilities, a accessible parking space, the entry and drive, paving one at the Redcoats Complex. We also have equipment purchase and replacement of the roof at Stratford. So $170,000 in the upcoming fiscal year, $1.5 million for parks over the 6 years of the plan. Police, primarily, this is items related to the Law Enforcement Center. As you know, Law Enforcement Center related items are typically split by formula with Midland County as a co-tenant within the building. So we've got two boiler replacements, a camera system for the Law Enforcement Center, and two rooftop units for the HVAC system proposed, as well as the addition of a SWAT vehicle, which would ultimately be integrated into the equipment revolving fund after purchase. That's an item that was discussed at your retreat last month. $640,000 for the upcoming fiscal year. That is the bulk of the 6 year plan, which is itself only at $744,000. Public works activities, again, kind of a catch-all for some of the projects that don't fit within some of the other activity areas. No projects proposed in 24-25. In the 6 year plan, $375,000 in projects. Senior housing at Riverside Place in 24-25, we have a berm and parking lot project. This is a project that would be funded using some of our community development block grant disaster recovery funds at $1 million. And then at Washington Woods, $250,000 for intercom replacement for 214 units. So a $1.25 million plan for 24-25, a $3.36 million plan over the 6 year plan period. Stormwater, and so continuing our work on concept five, and we've got those projects pulled out for you at the bottom of the table. Over $1.5 million of concept five related work occurring in stormwater. in the upcoming fiscal year. We also give you some heads up on a few projects that are shown here in 24-25 back in December, including our Barstow Woods stormwater project, replacing a failed stormwater pipe that runs through that park with an open drain at $1 million. So just shy of $10 million in stormwater projects in the upcoming fiscal year, and just over $16 million in the six-year plan. Water plan and water distribution, just shy of $3 million in the upcoming fiscal year. A lot of very exciting equipment out at the water plant. Just over $10 million in the six-year plan for a water plant and water distribution. Water reclamation, again, with concept five, we've got a pretty big year coming up in 24-25, just shy of $20 million in projects. The vast majority, that making up over half of the six-year plan, proposed projects at just about $36 million. These are the non-concept five projects. Again, another project highlighted back in December was the proposed expansion of the water reclamation building to accommodate additional staffing and training space, 2,250 square foot addition identified there. Otherwise, pretty typical replacements of equipment around the plant. Looking at concept five, we'll be continuing that project in 24-25. Those projects that are included in the upcoming fiscal year are listed there, bringing in our total for the year at $19,400,000 for water reclamation. And that's the last plan area. So the resolution before you this evening receives the proposed 2025 to 2030 capital improvement plan as recommended by the Planning Commission. Three-fifths votes required to approve the resolution. We're not looking for adoption of the plan this evening, just questions, comments, and we'll bring back a final plan for your consideration at your February 19th meeting.
All right, does anyone have any questions for Mr. King?
I have one more question. I promise it'll be my last one. So for maintenance at the law enforcement center, it's a 65-35 split. How is that decided versus a 50-50 split?
Based on the square footage used of the building.
Okay, so we use more of the building than county.
We do.
Okay. Other questions for Mr. King?
Yeah, I didn't want you to think you got off too easily. a couple things. Obviously, we, sitting here at City Council, they have no idea on a lot of these items, whether they're appropriate or not. Sometimes, what caught my eye was $75,000 for the Larkin parking garage signs, but actually that includes gates, so that's more understood. You rattled off $18,000 for a floor scrubber at the City Hall. That must be a heck of a floor scrubber.
Municipal Service Center.
Okay. So I still assume $18,000?
Likely working in some of the equipment bays that have to be cleaned as well. So we're talking about a floor scrubber.
We don't have the detail to really scrutinize. So we have to kind of trust that level of detail, not you specifically, because I know you're getting it from everybody else. But so most of this stuff is just, we don't have the ability or the insight to really know whether it's true or not. We're just kind of assuming that you do and trusting on that. But let me focus on a couple things that are very visible. And they really relate mostly to streets, but since it was brought up just a minute ago, the Saginaw Road.
What page are you on?
What page? I'm just looking at what he proposed, okay?
I've been looking at
it. So the circle area, we put $500,000 in the budget for design and engineering for 24-25. But up to this point, we haven't agreed on a design, I think, even. And so I'm trying to understand what that work would do and how does that relate to the comment, which I thought was pretty valid, about making sure you get public input on the early side of this before we go forward with any sort of design. So it's really a question of timing more than the amount, but let's make sure we get the right design, the right concept put before we do start doing designing and engineering. And then let me just, I'll talk one more point here. The other thing is what you hear
about any of the projects that we do that maybe might be perceived as non-essential, people immediately go to the fact that that money could be spent on streets, okay? And you've got a list of streets here. And I'll pick two that I know about because they're my neighborhood. And I know one in particular is Campbell, which and the other is Drake. But on Campbell, in particular, I've got one resident, Jim Bourne, I'll use his name, has been going on about the condition of Campbell for at least 3 years. That's not scheduled to be repaired until the 26-27 season, which is another 3 years out. And I can verify it's in terrible shape. But a parallel street also is Drake, which is also on that same timeline. It's currently not in very good shape. A couple things about those streets. What's on the list is basically what I would say roughly 7 blocks of an 8-block street. They're both equal length. They stop at Dillaway as opposed to the repair work listed stops at Dillaway when it goes actually one more street, one more block forward to Longfellow. And I'm curious why it stopped there and why it's out three more years out when both those are basically used. And not that they're in poor condition and not that they aren't in poor condition, but they're also used by buses and people, parents picking up their kids from school. So it gets a lot of traffic. So these are heavily used residential streets, even though they're local streets, that are used, you know, driven a lot by the school. So that's just an example of that I know of that says, you know, maybe we're waiting too long and not putting enough emphasis on these local streets. And there's probably other major streets as well. So that's something in this capital improvement plan that I think could be pushed harder forward and probably include even more streets than are listed. So I don't know if you want to comment on the circle thing and then comment on how the streets are developed, are determined with respect to the capital improvement plan.
Sure. So starting with the circle, I would argue we're not starting at zero. The city has an adopted redevelopment plan for Center City that was adopted in 2019. And so we have some conceptual ideas about how the streetscape projects would look throughout the corridor. Those concepts help to inform phase one of the project, which is complete. Obviously, there was some additional work done to bring those concepts for phase one to a final design that will also help to inform what happens in phase two. Certainly, individual design elements of the circle plan itself are not fully thought out in that concept plan. It's really just testing and talking to the public through that process about what they want to see, what their goals are for the circle, knowing what I've said, at least since I've been here, anytime I've talked about that circle is it's a situation that can't be perfected. The circle is about trade-offs. It's a complicated intersection. We've got a lot of roads intersecting. We have a lot of businesses present there. If there was a magic way of making the circle work for everyone perfectly, I'm sure Midland would have found it by now. It's just a complicated intersection. So it's going to have to be a conversation with the community about what are the trade-offs we want to make in terms of access to businesses, pedestrian friendliness, and through traffic being the three that come to mind for me as being at the top of the list of things that we'll have to figure out the right balance for. And that could be the current balance, that could be a different balance than what we're experiencing today. But this design and engineering process moving into that helps us to get into more of those details and figure out what that final design would look like, what it would cost to build, and then enable the funding to be identified to actually make it a reality. In terms of street prioritization, we hear that comment a lot too at City Hall, and I think it's important to note, number one, we'd obviously like to reconstruct more streets every year than we do, but we run into limitations with local contractor capacity, with our own internal capacity on how many projects we can handle in a given year, and in the funding. So we need to use our funding wisely on what we can. We're also not just prioritizing projects based on surface condition, and so the underground infrastructure sometimes drives a project higher on the list if we've got a water main that's in desperate need of repair. The surface conditions might arguably not put it even in the bottom 100 streets in Midland, but if the water line's in the bottom 100, that project's gonna need to move up because we can't get to the water line without rebuilding the street. So that's probably, I would say, the most common reason why you might see some of those prioritization decisions be made in a way that doesn't maybe make sense just looking at the street. And I would imagine that's probably informing some of the decisions with the streets you mentioned tonight.
Well, I think of the streets I mentioned, some of them where the repair is short, that maybe that's just an oversight, honestly.
I doubt it. I mean, we typically don't do the entire duration of every street in one shot. And so
this is literally 90% of the street in your.
So it may be a difference in surface condition. It may be the presence or absence of a water line or a water line in need of repair under the street. And it could be an oversight. So I'd be happy to look into it.
All right. Go ahead.
If I could just jump in.
Yeah, go ahead.
So can you kind of explain the concept? Because I've had a couple constituents ask me, such as James and Cruz, where we're going to do the portion of that. And they're saying, well, the other side streets that connect them and everything, why aren't we just doing those at the same time? Can you just kind of talk about that process, of why we do that and why we don't do that?
Yeah, and so sometimes, so in that instance, I think we're reconstructing just about every street in the neighborhood over the next couple of years. We just approved bids for Andre and Mattis at your last meeting or two meetings ago. Partly it's a matter of access. And so for the same reason, we're not going to reconstruct all of Jefferson in one summer and Creek Gridlock. We need to have available detours for folks and to enable our service providers to be able to get access to the neighborhoods. And so we may spread projects out over a few years in order to give us that opportunity for neighborhood access rather than just having the whole neighborhood shut down for a summer. I can appreciate as a resident why you might like that, why that might be beneficial, but you may also find that in practice, it's not quite as nice as it sounds like in theory.
Let me kind of conclude with one last couple of questions. Is there an inventory of all the streets in Midland as far as when they were built and when and if they were ever last significantly repaired, not patched, right, or not, you know, covered over because we had a water main break, but a complete reconstructing, because I think there's some question there that you see some streets that, I mean, I could tell you my neighborhood or my particular street, and I've lived there, I don't know, 25 years or something, it's never been repaired, never been reconstructed at all. Now it's not in terrible shape, so I'm not putting this as a personal request. But when I look out 6 years from now, I think it probably is going to need to be on that list because it's not, you know, it's not that great. So is there an inventory of, like I'm asking, you know, of all the streets, when it was constructed and when it was last reconstructed? So that's the one question. And then maybe just a parting thought is that I know you're pretty far along or nearly complete with this particular capital improvement plan, but if we do it again, I think we ought to really look at how to put more resources, figure out what our constraints might be to do more street repairs, because I think that's really what the community is demanding. At least that's what I'm hearing. And I think it comes, like I said, it comes up in every conversation when there's a request for an expenditure. And so I think the message there is we have improvements that we need to be doing to the streets. So I guess maybe answer the first question if you know, and the second one is a takeaway.
Sure. So first question, yeah, we have a lot of data on our streets, and not in every case. Some streets, the reconstruction may have happened well before we were capturing that data, but we certainly keep that in our GIS moving forward, and so we'll have better data over time. Remind me the second question.
The second question was just a takeaway in terms of the next time we do a capital improvement plan.
More on maintenance or repair.
On street maintenance, sure. And repair. Exactly.
So I wanted to note that we do have more money budgeted in the upcoming fiscal year in this plan than we do in the current year. And we have that additional money programmed through the 6 years of the plan. And I was just going to look those numbers up. I believe we doubled the local street mill and fill budget in this plan from 500,000 to 1 million per year. And I want to say major streets went from 250 to 500. So we will start to see more of that activity happening. We also, obviously, over time, our goal is to be in a position where we have fewer streets in need of reconstruction because we have that ongoing, not just mill and fill, but the crack sealing, the pothole filling, the simple treatments that help to keep the road in better condition over the long run.
Yeah, hopefully we'll continue that trend.
But not that stone thing.
Well,
do you know what
I don't want
to
never,
that's a chip and seal,
never right? say never, but we don't have any chip sealing program for the upcoming summer.
Yeah, it's just a car paint.
Other than the repairs.
Yeah. Okay. I know so, that does extend the life in some regard. However, it does make all the neighbors crazy, including myself when it was happening in my own neighborhood. I'm done with my
sense.
Little editorial comment there. So, Tim, were you going to comment?
No.
If I could just clarify real quick to Councilman Arnosky's question. So major streets, we currently have $200,000 program for service treatment, and that's up to 500. For local streets, it's gone from 250 to a million. So okay. We've quadrupled the amount of money that's proposed over the 6 years versus what's in the current plan.
Well, I think we almost want to see that year over year.
Well, in each of the 6 years, it's programmed at that higher rate in the proposed plan.
I think we, okay, but message is it could probably still increase.
So if I can just add on, if I may, mm-hmm. just before you go, excuse me. One of the things that Jacob, unbeknownst to him when he took his new job and some of the responsibilities, is that there's an outstanding request to have essentially what you're asking about, which is really a look at the streets, the condition of the streets, not so much the age. We don't necessarily worry about the age. It's more the condition. You recall going back to City Engineer McManus, and mm-hmm. we talked about those different curvers, and we interject yep. at different times. So we need to take a look at that. We know, generally speaking, the percentages of the streets that are in which condition. What we need to do is figure out, okay, what would it take to get from where we are to where we want to be?
Yeah.
And that's a much longer range plan, quite frankly, than a six-year plan. But what it does and will involve is two different things. First of all, if we just continue to spend the money that we have proposed in this six-year capital plan, where does that put us in 6 years? And part two of that question then becomes, if that's not good enough, then what will it take as far as particularly financing in order to get us there? And those would be questions that would then be put back in front of you as council to say, look, if you want to get to where you say you want to get to, this is what it's going to cost. Are you willing to sort of bite that bullet to get there? So that's something Jacob is aware of now.
No, I knew about
that's
it before
a plan
tonight.
Between engineering and planning, they will be working on.
Yeah, because I just sense that it's insufficient. And like I said, I'm just looking at my own street, which is okay now, probably okay next year. I don't think it's going to be okay in 6 years, and it's not on the list.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sorry.
Okay, so my question was, and we've been having this discussion, we've been hearing this from the community for a long time, and you kind of touched on it when I was going to ask about the financing. So I know we have two millages that help fund the roads. We also have money from all of the Concept 5, so if we're digging out, you know, replacing the pipes and all that, the roads are redone. So to say we want to double our spend means we have to raise those millages and ask for more money, because it doesn't just come out of, you know, money just doesn't grow on trees. Is that right?
In the very short sentence, yes. And in a longer explanation, there are other state funds that come to us, for instance, Gas and Weight and the Act 51 funds and so forth. Those mm-hmm. are generally set. They fluctuate a little bit, but they're going to be about the same. The two millages, they renew every other, they're four-year millages. Every other year, one of them comes up for renewal. So presuming, which is not always a safe thing to do, but presuming that the voters are generous and continue to renew those, we'll continue to have those funds. To raise more, you have two options. You either have another or a higher millage, a proposal that comes in that is voted on by the taxpayers, or you take money from the general fund to put towards it, which of course means then you're taking money from something else in order to do it. So those would be, frankly, your two primary sources. And there's always opportunities for grants and so forth, but those are not long-term sustainable funding sources.
Do we have one of the millages up for renewal in November? Or we still have two more years?
I believe it's even number of years that come up. I'm not positive. I can look into that and confirm that for you.
Okay. Any more comments or questions for Jacob, or comments in general as it relates to this? Okay.
Thank you.
Good. Thank you very much. Oh, I got, okay, thanks. And I do, So are there any comments from the public as it relates to this? Okay, well, I guess we covered it all. All right, yay.
So, Madam Mayor, just as a reminder, last year when we, Jacob, when he came in, he prepared a much more robust capital improvement plan than you had seen previously. And it was presented to you, and you essentially had that night to digest it, look at it, and approve and adopt it. And so one of the feedback comments that we received at the time was that you needed more time. So tonight, again, is for the purpose of receiving this only, production of the presentation, of this was to make sure that you understood the major concepts of this, but you'll now have another couple of weeks to sort of digest what you've heard, read through it in more detail now that some explanation has been provided, and it would be the next meeting, not tonight, that you actually would adopt this.
Will it be the next meeting, the 19th or whatever?
Yes. So it's, so opportunity for people to get in touch with, let us know what your thoughts are as it relates to this, or come to our next meeting, or come to the next meeting. All right, thanks for that update. All right, then that takes us down. So
there is a motion just to simply receive
and file, okay. Lace. Wait, we got to have Lacey read it first. Lace.
This resolution receives the proposed 2025-2030 capital improvement plan as recommended by the Planning Commission.
Okay, can I have a motion to accept?
So moved.
Second.
First and second. Any other discussion on this? All right, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay, that passes 5-0. Okay. Well, that takes us down to new business.
It does.
Okay. So I do have one little piece of new business in that we do need to interview for the Aviation Advisory Commission. And so the last time we did that was in 2022, and Marty and Pam Hall did the interviews for that in 2022. And prior to that, it was in 2020, and Steve and I did the interviews for that. So that leaves. Ta-da! So let it work out. Can you guys find the time to get together to do that? All right. Thank you very much. So that's all the new business that I have. Any other new business for you?
That is our major one. We do hope that this is our, for council at least, this will be our last meeting in this room. Our hosts here at the county have been very gracious with us. But at the moment, our contractors at City Hall are telling us that our council chambers will be ready. Which, Mayor, you saw it earlier today. I have a hard time believing that, but they keep telling me it will be. So unless you hear different from me, next time you're back in 2 weeks' time, we'll be back at City Hall.
All right, then. With that, we're adjourned. Thank you.